That ceremony also, one of the torchbearers was a rhythmic gymnast called Elena Kabaeva. Yes, a rhythmic gymnast as a torchbearer at a Winter Olympics, guys.
She's a rhythmic, not an arrhythmic gymnast, yes. Which would be amazing.
I mean, you could get away with so much.
Oh, yeah. I would. Yes, there's all the marks are for interpretation.
Or you lose marks if something is in time.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where we celebrate the best of the worst. I am Ben Vanderveld, and you join me here, not in our usual recording studio, but in the echoey, cavernous arena of Wembley as we prepare for the opening of this show. In front of me are tens of thousands of dancers all practicing with their tits and their teeth, but the problem is that their teeth are where their tits are and the tits are where their teeth are. They look like they're covered in shiny gold sequins, but I'll level with you, my friends, it's actually a very rare form of leprosy. And we're preparing to attach a variety of rocket boosters to two 30-foot tall wooden spoons that we have not got airspace clearance for, and we expect to be shot down by RAF fighter planes. And with me is the rusty pitchfork to my flaming torch, Barry McStay.
It's such an honour to be here with you, Ben. I feel like it's a momentous occasion that we finally had an opening ceremony for the podcast.
Yes, it really is.
60-odd episodes in.
Yeah, and what's lovely is we're going to have a parade of all the previous guests from all the different nations. Just like there's it's a team of British white guys. Oh, yeah. Another team of British white guys.
can we have a Dimbleby doing the commentary, please?
At least one. Can we get Zeppo?
And Claire Balding interviewing random members of the crowd.
Yeah.
They're yet to gather, we'll be honest.
They are yet to gather. Oh, it'd be a very disappointing Worst Foot Forward opening ceremony if people actually gathered here. But they've got to have the tiny pointless flags, you know, the flags that are like barely bigger than a fist. And when you can only wave them quickly. You can't wave it slowly.
Yeah, you can't do a slow wave.
Oh, no, but you should be. We should have kind of like a topless giant leading out all the troops. The great Carly from the wrestling episode with a tiny little Worst Foot Forward flag.
What band do we need to get to reform to perform at the opening ceremony? Because, you know, the London Olympics had the Spice Girls. We could have Daphne and Celeste come back together.
We really should. You know they're playing soon.
We know they're... Come on, guys. Come on. This is where you really should be. This is your spiritual home. Back with us here at Worst Foot Forward, singing you all of your greatest hit for us.
But instead of the Spice Girls on top of a red London bus, it's just Daphne and Celeste on a, like, shonky knockoff taxi each.
I think the Spice Girls were on taxis.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, I think they were. I think they had taxis with guardrails. And it was sort of four of them singing very enthusiastically and Victoria pouting.
So no change there.
Anyway, enough of this nonsense. Let's introduce our guest.
Yeah, we need to... I mean, at the opening ceremony, he is our dignitary today.
Sorry, yes. Everybody please be upstanding as he leaps out of a helicopter to join us here. Our guest today has a degree in modern and medieval languages from the University of Cambridge, no less. So is the perfect travelling companion for a jaunt through Germany, Spain, or 13th century Normandy. He is now an actor, writer, director, a contributor to the Stage newspaper, and a man whose work has led him to the grand old stages like the Chichester Festival Theatre, the Old Vic, and the National Theatre, and to an impressive number of credits on BBC Radio. He's regular on radio plays and most notably was a writer for radio show That Mitchell and Webb Sound and a writer and performer on its BAFTA-winning TV successor That Mitchell and Webb Look. He has also specialised as a writer on shows pointing out TV mistakes and 10 things to hate about the years 1999, 1987 and 1995. In fairness, every other year has been just great with nothing bad happening whatsoever. It's only natural that he'd find his way onto a show all about celebrating mistakes. It's the unmistakable John Dryden Taylor.
Thank you very much. It's
You're very welcome. And where was the fanfare? Somebody shoot that children's orchestra.
Am I actually James Bond now? Because you did say jumping out of the helicopter.
I think that makes you James Bond.
I think that makes me Bond. Step aside, Daniel Craig.
He's still got the Queen attached to his back throughout the interview. She's just there in a harness like a giant baby.
She was great in that, by the way.
What was... Like,
She played that role really well.
Well, she played the role of the Queen very well.
Yeah, but I mean, she could have hammed it up a little bit.
She could have made some bold choices and decided not to go for your standard Queen, but she went straight down the line.
Yeah, you could do too much with that.
To be fair, as a shape-changing lizard, she has been playing that role well for 60 years.
It's your favourite theory, this.
Because it's true.
What a way to enter the opening ceremony, though, if she shed her human skin
and then consumed the whole Tuvalu team.
Crawled onto a rock in the middle of the stadium, catching the sunlight and charged herself up.
You said that James Bond was a backup.
Yeah.
It's like, if she won't do the lizard thing, we'll pitch her Bond.
Yes, right.
When you say charged herself up, are you suggesting...
They're cold-blooded creatures, aren't they, lizards? They lie on rocks to heat themselves up. Yeah, she's like an iPhone that you can charge wirelessly. If you pick the Queen up and put her on a hot plate.
And pretty soon...
Don't do that at home.
Yeah. What, put the Queen on a hot plate?
Please don't try this at home, kids.
That is definitely treasonous.
Please ask your parents to use your monarch.
If you're sat in the Tower of London next to someone, what did you do here? Oh, I actually tried to steal the crown jewels. What about you? I put the Queen on a hot plate.
To charge her? I mean, I wasn't being mad.
It was only after you realised she didn't have a USB port that...
It was
your second choice. John, we always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What would you say that would be for you?
It's such a temptation to do the sort of false modesty job interview thing and say, I'm just too much of a perfectionist.
Of course.
I care a bit too much. I went through various options. I'm really bad at longhand writing, as I realised when I was doing my research for this, but everyone is, because nobody writes anything
That's
anymore.
It, yeah, yeah.
And you think back to A-levels, and it's like 2-3 hour exams in a day, and it's like, what happened to my hands? But like I said, that's universal. So what I'm definitely worst at is... allowing things to be wrong, is letting things go when they're wrong. So if I see, hear, read, understand that something that I deem to be incorrect is anywhere in the universe, I start twitching and it literally dominates my thoughts. It's some kind of pathology.
Do you feed the trolls? In the world of Twitter, that sounds like something where you have to fight every online battle.
There is one... meme on Twitter that friends of mine deliberately post to see if I will bite, which has been around for years, and it's this image of some 1920s women in bathing suits, and it says that early suffragettes used to gather for pizza eating parties to annoy men.
Oh, yes.
And it's such bullshit on so many levels that friends of mine literally do dangle it on Twitter in front of me to see if I'll yap at it. And I always do. And of course, it always comes across as... something very sort of, well, actually, and very self-satisfied. And it's very difficult to explain in 280 characters that, no, this is my pathology, and I won't be able to sleep unless I say that actually it was 1987, not 1989.
But this sort of stuff is going to be the saviour of civilization, because we're in a post-truth world.
Yeah.
Like, who knows? There is so much of, not like the harmful stuff that's posted by Trumpists and people like that, but just... you know, as somebody studied history at uni as well, people just throw historical fact around willy-nilly without caring what year or... not caring that anything looks right and matches in what they're writing about.
Well, the suffragettes and pizza is a really huge example of that, because it's...
Because Marco Polo didn't bring pizza back from China until 1947.
and then it was cold, so we had to send it back.
That was the first ever Deliveroo.
And Betty White had a few things to say about that. It's just the history of it is all over the place in an annoying way. But I need to lay off it. In the best man speech at my wedding, my best man, who was a comedian, so I could expect a bit of a roasting, but he made a running gag out of the fact that I have this compulsion. So I think his first line was something like, I first met John in 1993 or 1994. It doesn't matter. And kept coming back to this. It doesn't matter theme all the way through the speech. So I guess that's what I'd have to be worst at, just letting things go.
Ladies and gents, we are talking about the world's worst opening ceremony. There is, I'm sure, a variety of ramshackle jamborees to talk about.
I'm so glad you picked this. Oh my God, why did you pick this subject?
Well, for a number of reasons. When I first started thinking about World's Worst, I thought I could use something that I had direct experience of, which I don't have of ceremonies, but I have stayed in literally the World's Worst Hotel. I went on a holiday with a friend of mine who I stupidly allowed to arrange an all-inclusive holiday for us. And I should have, it should have rung a bell when it was like 150 quid for a week all inclusive. But I was pretty skint, so I went along. And when we were in the transit from the airport to the hotel, he said to me, I should tell you that I've looked this up on TripAdvisor and it's got the worst rating. And I naively said, "What? It's the worst hotel in Malta." And he said, "No."
Wow.
It had the lowest global rating on TripAdvisor.
That was incredible.
So that was a fun week. But then I thought to research that, I'd have to go and stay in a load of other horrible hotels. To see if it was
Bless you for wanting to get really go method with the research. What was so bad about it?
The best description I could give you as to sort of sum up how terrible it was is that there was one of those polystyrene kebab or chip boxes in the corridor outside our room on the day we arrived and the day we left.
That's just room service.
I should have opened it.
Yeah.
It would have had gold inside.
Be so scared. You'd open it and then just be a rat inside going, fuck off, this is mine.
Do you mind? Keep the noise down. We've been here. They built the hotel around us.
I've always been obsessed with how, with what a weird concept, particularly for sporting events, opening ceremonies are, because it's like going to the proms and them saying, you know, before the Mahler concert that's opening this season, here's 4 hours of football. And you, if somebody's never heard of the Olympics, they turn on the opening ceremony and they go, all right, well, this is a festival of drumming and big puppets. So we'll see how that goes.
Right then, Barry, make us feel even more depressed. Tell us about some terrible opening ceremonies.
First thing I want to talk to you about, have you heard of Mr. First and Mr. Second?
No.
These guys are fucking great. Mr. First is a guy called Omero C. Catan. He died about 10 years ago, I think. And maybe a bit more, 20 years ago. And in 1928, at the age of 13, he was an American guy, he met a guy who was the first man to cross the New Brooklyn Bridge back in 1883. And he thought, what a really great way to witness things, be the first person to do things. So a few weeks later, he was the very first person to take a tour of the Graf Zeppelin. And he did 536 other firsts in his life. He basically made it his life's goal to be at the opening of things and be the first to do such and such a thing. He was the first to buy a ticket on the 8th Avenue subway in 1932. In 1936, he was the first to skate on the Rockefeller Center ice rink in New York. In 1951, he's the first person to use a New York City parking meter. He was the first person to cross various bridges, the Triborough, the Whitestone, the George Washington, the Henry Hudson.
Is this the man who invented queue jumping?
He would ring up like local authorities and get them to reserve him a place. And after a while, he became sort of quite well known for being the first of these things, so they invited him to be the first to do things. But in 1945... the Lincoln Tunnel opened its third tunnel. And he'd been there, he was the first one through its first tunnel. But he was away in Europe, serving in World War II. So he sent his brother Michael instead to be the first through it. And he parked outside in his car. And it was really, really cold. So Howard Hughes brought him a hot plate to keep him warm and to chuck the Queen onto, presumably. And and then from then on, he kind of got in on the whole, I'm going to be first to things. So he began, I think people began to call him Mr. Second because he was the second Mr. First. But he would start deputised to his brother, and then he sort of went a little bit rogue and would be the first to a few things in his own right. Together,
this has got Ed and David Miliband written all over it, doesn't it?
They were the first to fly into Idlewild Airport in 1948. They chartered a plane to be the first ones to land. But the opening ceremony had some display of fighter jets or bombers flying past, and they nearly got sort of knocked out of the sky by these planes. Yeah, they entered in this sort of little contest and they became estranged from each other over who was the real Mr. First. There was an interview with Michael, who was the Mr. Second, later on in their lives, where the interviewer said, oh, you know, your brother has done whatever, 537 firsts. He says, oh, is it only 537? I thought it was more. Got really quite
snide.
Omero, Mr. First, said, he was asked, oh, would you like to have been the first person on the moon? He said, oh, I don't have that kind of nerve. But he said if he'd been the first person to fly to Paris, to beat Lindbergh and be the first person to fly New York to Paris, oh, that would have been great. That's unique.
Were they buried in a particularly unique way?
And competitive way.
Anyway, how good would he be if you were Mr. Second and you died first?
Or if you were Mr. Second at Mr. First's funeral and just as the coffin's about to be lowered in, Mr. Second dives in underneath. Beat you to it again. I'm just going to shout out a couple of the famous opening ceremonies that you guys may well have read up about.
Uh-huh.
We all saw Diana Ross miss that penalty, right?
Yeah.
There is an alternative sliding doors universe.
Yes.
In which Diana Ross scored the penalty competently, and the 94 opening ceremony was just as dull and unmemorable as every other. Because researching this show, I looked up a photo album of football World Cup opening ceremonies, and I've watched every World Cup since 1982.
Yeah.
I do not remember a frame of any of them other than Diana Ross. Before the 1998 World Cup final, Ronaldo was missing Brazil-France.
Yeah.
Right? Yep.
There was a fashion show in the Stade de France with lots of Gaultier designs. No memory of it at all.
Jean-Paul Gaultier slammed in a free kick from 30 yards out.
Amazing curl around the ball.
I think the sliding doors universe is that Diana Ross scored the penalty and that Colombian defender didn't get killed by the mob.
Poor old Escobar. Yes, if people don't know, Diana Ross at the 1994 World Cup opening ceremony, which everyone always said was a bit bizarre holding it in America because football's not massive in America now, but it was even smaller in America back then. But she did a sort of a run the length of Soldier Field in Chicago while not singing "I'm Coming Out." There's a lot of waving the microphone above her head when apparently her voice is being played over the loudspeakers. And obviously she's doing a length of a football pitch in an early 90s pantsuit while being surrounded by a group of performers holding what look like white riot shields, and eventually gets down to the end of the pitch where there is a goal set up, and she's taking a penalty from the guts of 6 yards. I think it looks like an oversized goal and an undersized penalty box, and she hooks the ball horrendously left of the goal. And the Metro and the Telegraph and a few other places where I read about this, they were reminiscing about this thing, said, oh, and to add to the embarrassment, the goal fell apart. And you go, no, she's meant to score it and smash the goal apart. And instead, it just looks like, oh, the goal has collapsed.
Yeah.
On top of all of this.
A lot of those articles, we've probably seen some of the same ones in researching this, feel to me like those shows, as you've mentioned, I've written the odd clip show in my time, where there is a comedian who has clearly just been shown a piece of footage for the first time and is pretending to have remembered it for 30 years.
Yes, yeah. Mm.
And of course, that was when... And all these people writing about Diana Ross's penalty have absolutely never heard of it until they've been told to write about
it. Yeah, exactly.
Which, I mean, defining moment of my youth, it really was. Ray Houghton's smashing goal against Italy.
Oh, yeah. That was a defining moment of my youth.
Yeah, damn right. Well, that was the only thing I could get as an England fan at that World Cup. I think the only presence that England had at that World Cup was Chris Waddle and Stuart Pearce being Diana Ross's penalty coach.
Or singing coach from Chris Waddle's case.
Did we see the 2014 Sochi Winter Games opening ceremony?
Oh, yeah.
This is the when they had sort of little snowflakes which were meant to expand to form sort of beautiful white Olympic rings. There were five little snowflakes and they'd expand and interlink and become the five Olympic rings. And only four of them expanded. And there was one in the top right, so it looked like an asterisk to the games, like there'd be a footnote somewhere that you had to go and find. That ceremony also, one of the torchbearers was a rhythmic gymnast called Elena Kabaeva. Yes, a rhythmic gymnast as a torchbearer at a Winter Olympics, guys.
So she's rhythmic, not an arrhythmic gymnast, which would be amazing.
I mean, you could get away with so much.
Oh, I would. Yes, there's all the marks are for interpretation.
Or you lose marks if something is in time.
Yes. My husband has an amazing ability to clap just out of time, which Ben will know, to click or clap just out of time in a really annoying way.
Yeah. Oh, the best one of that is one of our very first guests, Jay Foreman, who can sing any Beatles song in the world a beat behind.
Yeah.
It's hugely... Oh, that set off John's pathology right there.
Stress me so much.
Elena Kabaeva, this rhythmic gymnast, she was at the time a member of the Duma. So, okay, well, she's a member of Parliament. But, oh, what's this? She was Vladimir Putin's then girlfriend, you say? No. Aged just about 30 years old, you say? Flexible gymnast. What a coincidence she ended up carrying this torch. And, hey, not a year later, she gave birth to a child in Switzerland in 2015 in March. You remember that Vladimir Putin went missing for about 10 days in March 2015? Nobody quite knows who this child is, but anyway, there you go. Mother of Vladimir Putin's presumed love child, torchbearer at the 2014 Sochi Games.
You need to be very careful accepting cups of tea from anyone.
I know. I mean, I imagine I'm down the bottom of a very long list. One other torchbearer who had a less fortunate time, perhaps, than Elena was Helen Sharman. Very famous in her day, in the early 90s particularly, because obviously she was sent to Mir. She spent quite a long time on Mir, and she was a major celebrity. And she just showed up at lots of stuff in the early 90s when she came back. She was on TV and opening events. And the 1991 World Student Games were held in Sheffield in the UK, where Helen was from. And I believe maybe had studied as well at the University of Sheffield. So she was the natural choice to be the person to actually light the flame, even though she wasn't a competitor. She was this iconic figure at the time. And so she took the torch from the last bearer and set off running down the track towards the actual big bowl itself. And she missed her step. And to regain her balance, she tipped forward and tipped the coals out of the flame onto the floor. And was left sort of momentarily like rabbit in headlights looking at the now empty torch. And I'm pretty sure the thought went through her head, do I bend down and pick them back up? Does someone have a pooper scooper to help me get these flames? And instead, no, she just was sort of told to keep going. Some person with a headset shows up and just goes, no, keep running. And so she's running, holding what is ostensibly now a metal baton.
The sort of shit you'd expect from an arrhythmic gymnast, to be fairly honest.
Yeah. Bless them, the commentators on the clip are like, well, what a moment of drama in an otherwise perfect opening ceremony.
Yeah,
will the flame light? Will it light? Of course it does, they're all done on gas now.
That reminds me of a story that a friend of mine, a comedian called Steve Day, tells about being at the Paralympics in London in 2012. And Steve is the only deaf comedian on the circuit. And he was there with then Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. And there was a relay of torchbearers of various disabilities who were coming up to the torch. And the final guy with disability had cerebral palsy. So he was coming down, I think, the mall, maybe. And as he just gets in sight, it's already running a little bit late. And Boris Johnson, like the absolute fuckwit that he is, goes, 10.
Oh,
9. Oh, no. Hey, bear in mind, this man is 100 metres away and Usain Bolt can run that in 10 seconds. And apparently just the look in this guy's eyes are like, this is not going to be my day, is it?
4.5.
Yeah.
4.25. Football unveilings, by the way, don't always go off without a hitch. In Spain particularly, there's the whole ceremony of you go out and you parade in front of thousands of fans in your home stadium and you do some keepy uppies and wave to the crowd. And, well, there's a whole raft of footballers where you can find clips of them being unveiled in Spanish football stadiums failing to do more than a couple of keepy uppies. For example, Ousmane Dembele, when he moved to Barcelona last year, Real Madrid's Theo Hernandez did 3 or 4 and then did that thing where, you know, they've lost control of it and they're chasing the ball around trying to keep it up in the air, and then just left it and began waving to the crowd very quickly to get them to cheer and like kissing the badge so that they'd move on quickly from the missed keepy uppies. And best of all, Paulinho, when he was unveiled as Neymar's replacement last year, a man who was at one point voted Spurs' worst ever player and was brought in from China. That's how good his career was at that point before Barca brought him in. Fans were so unimpressed by him that they only sold one jersey with his name on it on the day he was unveiled.
And that was to his mum.
That was to one very happy looking fan in a car park by the look of the picture I found. But if you consider that when Neymar moved to PSG, they sold something like 10,000 Neymar jerseys on the first day.
Oh my God.
It's a great start for Paulinho.
Talking about footballing unveilings, do you know about what happened to Les Ferdinand and many other British players when they went to play in Turkey?
No, of course.
So Les Ferdinand played for Beşiktaş.
Oh, yes.
And he was greeted at the airport by going, welcome, welcome. And then they draped a dead goat over him.
Oh, yes.
For good luck.
But my candidate for the world's worst opening ceremony was the opening of Disneyland on July 17th, 1955. Known by staff for many years afterwards as Black Sunday. So, Disney had been planning the park for a long time, but from breaking ground to the opening ceremony, he said the park was going to be open in a year and a day. So they opened it a year and a day after they started building it, spent $17 million on it. It was known in Hollywood as Walt's folly because nobody thought it was going to work. Even Roy Disney, who was the chief financial officer for the company at the time, hated the idea. He thought it was never going to turn into any sort of success. But Disney was such a massive brand, even back then, 70 million people tuned in to a 90-minute broadcast on ABC to see it being opened. It was hosted by Ronald Reagan. There was choirs. There was a minister there blessing it. Disney himself spoke. And the broadcast looked like it went off without a hitch. But behind the scenes, rides weren't working, including the Flying Dumbo ride and a thing called the Rocket to the Moon, which envisaged what it would be like in 1986 when trips to the moon were a regular thing at a part of the park called Tomorrowland. So many of the rides weren't working.
I imagine It's a Small, Small World was working. I imagine that they actually unearthed It's a Small, Small World that has just been playing for decades upon decades upon decades.
They haven't found an off switch.
No.
There were weeds along these sort of canals that the canal boat ride would go along, and they were so, because it was particularly humid, sort of sweltering summer that year, Disney had little signs with Latin names for the weeds put down along the canal to make it look like it was a deliberate sort of flora and fauna area for people to admire. It was 100 degrees plus, so the asphalt, which would be newly laid on Main Street USA, was melting and was trapping women in their high heels. There'd been a plumber's strike, so there was a distinct lack of drinking water on this very hot day. The Mark Twain riverboat was so overcrowded with people that it listed heavily and took on water and had to be closed. They had issued 15,000 invitation-only tickets, yet 28,000 people plus entered the park that day because there were so many fake tickets going around. And one guy charged people $5 a piece to use his ladder to climb over a bit of fence into the park.
Oh my God, it's like Glastonbury in the 90s.
It's amazing. So you can imagine, with minimal rides working, no water, and nearly twice as many people there, how long the queues for everything were. There were 7-mile tailbacks on the highways to get to the park, so kids trapped in cars on the hot days were having to piss by the roadsides and in the car parks
and then sell it as water
to people. All the food stands ran out and all the 3 restaurants that they had open, and it was just considered a complete disaster. And Disney said, oh, it'll probably take us a month to get up and running at full capacity. It did take about a month because one of the rides, the Stagecoach, was discovered to be too top heavy and flipped over with people on it later that month. And on another occasion, a tiger and a panther escaped from a circus parade and engaged in a fight to the death on Main Street USA.
Surrounded by stranded women stuck to the apple.
And presumably massive actors in Mickey Mouse costumes.
There were a lot of suspects that sprung to mind, and this is where I have to sort of explain the slightly cheating distinction I'm making between opening ceremonies and openings of ceremonies. Mm. Like if you just go ceremonies full stop, then you're into things like Sam Fox and Mick Fleetwood at the Brits that we've all talked about and heard about enough now. And there are sort of a few equivalents with opening ceremonies that were so spectacularly all over the place that we've heard a lot about them. So an example of that might be the Doves in Seoul in 1988.
Of course. I love this.
So good.
And the story comes down to us that the Doves flew into the Olympic flame and were roasted alive. And it's not quite true. That's a little bit of a tidying up.
It happened.
Because what happens is the Doves were released before the lighting of the flame, mistake number one. And so they thought, this looks like a nice place to perch.
Yeah, because the bowl is on a big column in the middle of the stadium.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so they're all, they do not fly into the flame. They are set on fire by some Korean athletic legends who don't, and I'm, having done sort of live performances as an actor, you do wonder what they are thinking in the moment.
Yeah.
And it seems to be that what all of them are thinking is, well, I'm just going to go ahead and light it anyway. There's no sort of, should we shoo them away? There's no, should I sort of hesitate with the torch? It's just, let's get this lit. And it looks so meant, you almost expect sort of Barry Davis to say, now the traditional incineration of the Doves.
Because the crowd are clapping and taking photos and the usual.
The ones that do fly away do fly back into it.
Yes, there are. They? To try pull their mates out in a dove cast version of London's burning. Souls burning.
That is, they're using an olive branch. Grab onto it. Oh, it's burnt.
We have roasted peace.
Yeah.
That's what we've done.
Because is it 1992 was Barcelona and the Archer
fire? That was
great. And that was the one where they made sure the thing is completely automated, so even if he missed with the arrow.
They originally were going to have Diana Ross fire that arrow. her early attempts weren't great.
She killed the rest of the Supremes in Paris.
And 40 Doves. I love the 1980 Moscow Olympics opening ceremony, which of course had loads and loads of athletes marching under the Olympic flag.
Lots of countries boycotting it and all that.
Yeah, because because of the boycott. So the city of Moscow sent all children between 7 and 15 for a day's holiday in the countryside. Like when you cover your eyes and go, you know, if I can't see you, you can't see me. If these kids don't see the opening ceremony,
they won't realise it's a protest.
Nobody's here. the great lip-syncing scandal of the Beijing opening ceremony.
Yeah.
And I'm where there was a girl who sang the song in the ceremony, so far as we were led to believe, but in fact it was another younger girl, a seven-year-old as opposed to a nine-year-old, whose teeth were not being deemed good enough.
It's called Yang Peiyi, was her name. Yeah, they didn't deem her pretty enough. Do you know that they passed a law after that about this?
Really?
Yeah, in China, after the whole scandal came out about, they'd been lip-syncing at the opening ceremony, they banned musicians and singers from miming to their tracks at public events after that.
All because that little girl's teeth weren't great.
Wow. Yeah. They have ruined Britney Spears in China.
Yeah.
I mean, I have poverty teeth, so I really resent what happened. But also,
that's why you didn't sing at London 2012, John.
That's it. I could have been Emily Sandé by now. But the thing about China is it's got a billion people in it. Can't you find a little girl who can both sing and clean her teeth? Apparently not. You mentioned London 2012, and London 2012, I think, was a fantastic opening ceremony, but sort of nearly creeps onto the list because of how wrong we've got it since.
Mm.
So there's this whole thing about London opened itself to the world and said, we are a wonderful, diverse, tolerant, wonderful, glorious, open, rainbow nation. And then since then, people have looked back at that ceremony to say, well, ours was the best, wasn't it? We did the best one. I think that's what that proved.
Everyone's like, going, wait for Brazil in Rio in 2016, going, well, it's going to be shit, isn't it? Because it's not going to be London.
Yeah, exactly the opposite of what the whole idea was going to be, was supposed to be. And there were a couple of things. There was a certain surreal edge at times. But
giant creepy baby.
Giant creepy baby, for example. In the Paralympics opening ceremony, somebody wrote a line to go after some Shakespeare, which is a bold move. So Ian McKellen comes out and does a bit of The Tempest, and then he has to say, after the Shakespeare speech, "Break the glass ceiling, Miranda, and set us all free!"
Yeah.
And it's like, don't put that after Shakespeare. It's a worthy message, but you know, it's like drawing a moustache on the Mona Lisa. You don't want your focus group's empowering line to come after. Not everyone loved the Olympics opening ceremony. Various Tory MPs said that it showed an unrepresentatively multicultural Britain. Toby Young said on Twitter it's like a party political broadcast for the Labour Party, which is a bit of an own goal because they're always pretending that the NHS is everyone's concern. And it's like the organisers of the Paralympic ceremony where Beverly Knight sang I Am What I Am.
Yeah.
It's like they looked at that response and thought, right, what's the gayest thing we can get someone black to do?
What is the gayest thing we can get someone black to do? Pretty certain that is Channel 4's mission statement.
So there's plenty around opening ceremonies of various kinds. And I wish that I could go into the amazing disaster that was Brooke Shields trying to sing a verse of an amazing song in the 2011 Tony
Awards.
But
she had two or three goals at it.
And even got counted in by Neil Patrick Harris.
Yes,
still couldn't do it. The one I've chosen is so extraordinary for so many reasons. If you look at it on YouTube, it's headed the 11 minutes that ruined Alan Carr's career. And so this is a producer called Alan Carr, not to be mistaken with Alan Carr or Alan Carr. So he won't help you to stop smoking and he doesn't have a Channel 4 show. But here's the thing about Alan Carr. In his obituary, he was described as fat, funny and flamboyant. His nickname was Kaftan's Courageous. The water in his Hollywood mansion swimming pool was dyed pink. What I'm saying is there wasn't a Mrs. Carr. although that might have been his nickname in the West End. But he started off as an agent. He was agent to Tony Curtis, to Peter Sellers, Joan Rivers, Mama Cass. And he was particularly good at discovering talent. He discovered Olivia Newton-John, Mark Hamill, Michelle Pfeiffer. So he had a good record in that period of his career. Then he moved into producing. He produced The Who's Tommy. And then in 1977... there was a Broadway show that everyone thought would make a good cartoon musical. So they were going to turn this Broadway musical into a cartoon film.
Mm.
And they asked Alan in to run the ad campaign. He ended up running the ad campaign, organising the launch, making a TV special about the film, co-producing it, oh, and by the way, writing the script.
Oh, no.
And cast his client, Olivia Newton-John, as Sandy for this film as Grease.
Okay.
Which was eventually, obviously, decided not to be a cartoon. He went on to produce the Village People film, which was notable by the fact that no mention of any perceived sexuality of any of the Village People happened at any point.
Isn't
in the
it
film.
Amazing that the Village People seems to contain just men?
He then went on to produce Carjo Fall on Broadway, so again, a certain kind of
good,
aesthetic.
Good credentials, then.
And, there was no Mrs. Carr.
Yeah.
But his Oscars that he organised were so disastrous that 17 prominent Hollywood figures, including Julie Andrews, Paul Newman, Gregory Peck, Billy Wilder, wrote a letter to the Academy to complain about it.
Like, those are proper Hollywood people as well.
Also, if you've pissed off Julie Andrews, you're doing well.
If you're a musical theatre queen, yeah, which he obviously was. Yeah. I mean, that is literally annoying God, isn't
yeah
it?
Yeah.
And it was so disastrous that when it was finally uploaded to YouTube 20 years later, it got 1 million views in a day.
Wow. Which year was this?
It was 1989.
1989
it was the 61st Oscars. Rain Man was Best Picture and Best Director. Mm-hmm. Jodie Foster won Best Actress for The Accused. Kevin Kline got Best Supporting for A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah.
Gina Davis won Best Supporting Actress from a category including Frances McDormand, who I now begin to think is like one of those sort of era-spanning vampires.
She'll
who
never
up
die.
In photos of the Kennedy assassination. Oh, Frances McDormand in a woody hat. And Best Actor was Dustin Hoffman, allegedly.
Mm.
It was also so disastrous, this Oscar ceremony, that Disney sued the Academy.
Wow.
Okay, we're going to set a fucking panther on you, mate.
Don't walk down our street in heels. Yeah.
Who was the host?
There was no host, which was part of the problem.
Wow.
The following year, the host was Billy Crystal, whose first line was a reference to the previous
year's. Oh, no.
So come, if you will, with me to 1989 Los Angeles. Inside the auditorium, a voice says, "Ladies and gentlemen, prepare to meet the greatest star of all." And they're all sitting there, sort of thinking, "It's
yeah, is it me?"
I was up for that. And what happens, in fact, is you cut to outside the auditorium, where a 22-year-old unknown singing actress called Eileen Bowman is dressed in the kind of Snow White outfit that you get your niece for Christmas if you don't like her. I mean, it's not her fault, but she's mistaken Snow White for sort of Betty Boop, so she sort of speaks like this and says, "Can you tell me the way to get into the theatre?" And a voice says, "That's easy, Snow. Just follow the Hollywood stars." And there are these dancers dressed in stars like it's World Fucking Book Day.
Oh, no.
And they run into the theatre and they start dancing on stage. Snow White comes in and starts sort of greeting the audience, waving and shaking, "Hello!" Shaking hands with the audience, who have not been primed for this. I mean, have some plants. Michelle Pfeiffer just pretends she's not there. And, you know, it's Michelle Pfeiffer who could freeze the Atlantic with an eyebrow. You do not want to go up to her and make her give you a look. She gets to the stage and sings song about, you know, it's the greatest night of the stars of the wonderfulness and the magic and all that. And you think, well, maybe that's it now and a host's going to come on. But there is so much more of this still to come. Tabs fly out and there's this sort of 50s tiki bar set and the voice says, "Welcome to the greatest place on earth, the Coconut Grove." And then a 50s talk show host called Merv Griffin comes on and sings "I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts." He'd sung the song once before. It wasn't connected to him in any way. He sings it in an English accent for some reason. There are women with coconuts on their heads that he dances around with. And sitting at the table, a lot of elderly, confused Hollywood stars. Roy Rogers is there. Vincent Price
is there.
Oh, no. Dorothy L'Amour from the Bing Crosby Bob Hope films.
Oh, no!
She stands there and does that sort of Hawaiian
hula girl dancing.
Hula girl, hands to one side dancing, looking just confused. Doris Day has the nous to be introduced and to fuck off the stage. Little wave and she's off. Sid Charisse does a brilliant dance and is classy, but mainly it's just lots of elderly people who don't know what's going on. I mean, we're still about a quarter of the way through this. Then Merv Griffin says, "Snow White, meet your blind date, Rob Lowe."
Oh, no!
This is just before the sex scandal. So
oh,
he's the sort of hottest Brat Pack actor. And he comes on and sings Proud Mary with her, obviously.
He sings Proud Mary with Snow White.
But the lyrics are altered to make it all about the movie industry. So they're singing, rolling, keep the cameras rolling. Oh, and Rob Lowe can't sing. And they do this for a bit, and then Rob Lowe tries to do the low bit and sort of ends up, keep the cameras rolling. And you think, thank God it's over. It's one of three false endings to Proud Mary alone. So then, and he sings more and worse. The only person who thought he was a good singer, apparently, was Lucille Ball, told him afterwards that he had a lovely voice, but she was dead within a month. So she's not the most reliable witness. And eventually, after what feels like the whole of your life, tabs fly out again, and it's the outside of Grauman's Chinese Theatre, a legendary Hollywood theatre where the Oscars were not being held that year. So they have a big song about how wonderful Grauman's Chinese Theatre is. Terrible lyrics. And then a lot of high-kicking ushers come on, because that's what you need. And then there's a whole two verses and a chorus of Hooray for Hollywood. It's like an MGM sort of wet dream of a 12-year-old who's just discovered musical theatre and homosexuality. And, in a year where, like, Rain Man is winning the best movie Oscar, it's sort of saying that every film is singing in the rain. In quite a gritty, dramatic...
Singing in the Rain Man. Please, can we make that happen?
I'm an excellent dancer. Oh, that's brilliant. And then Lily Tomlin comes on at the end, and she's scripted to say, 1.5 billion people have just watched that, but she really hits the inflection and says, 1.5 billion people have just watched that.
Well played, Lily.
Alan did get slightly the last laugh, because he did leave... He didn't work again after that. And
really?
Life got a bit sadder for Alan. He died 10 years later. But that 1989 Oscars was the first Oscars where the presenter said, and the Oscar goes to, instead of and the winner is.
Uh-huh.
It was which was Alan Carr's idea. He also had an idea to have separate sections on each of the Best Picture nominees.
Oh, yeah, which is still a thing.
And interviewing people on the red carpet was an Alan Carr idea, which for some people is all the Oscars now.
Wow, so he was really just a misunderstood genius who was ahead of his time.
Kind of. But nothing quite compares to... Alan Carr's 11-minute video, you can find it on YouTube. It's both 11 minutes and 4 years long.
First of all, how could we mention Olympic opening ceremonies without talking about the Berlin Olympics of 1936? Now, obviously, I'm not going to go into too much detail, because all you need to know is that it opened with a song called Nazis, Nazis, Nazis. Loads of high-kicking, goose-stepping fun for all the family, and an oiled-up Aryan man with a tiny little swastika flag going round and round.
Snow very white.
But I mean, the problem that they had there is that they didn't have any Jewish producers, and they just had that to sort it out.
Didn't they play the German national anthem like thousands of times? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yep, that happened. My other favourite fact about it that is true is they didn't have doves, but they released thousands of birds, and they also at the same time let off lots of cannons, and the birds panicked and shat themselves all over the competitors and the Nazis there. With the birds, clearly the birds were a collection of left-wing pigeons who were like, I'm not happy with this.
City Nazis.
My favourite kind of Nazis next to a dead one. My other favourite opening ceremony story from a sporting event is from the 1988 African Cup of Nations.
Oh, yeah.
They were meant to have a variety of parachutists land in the centre circle, and parachutists 1 through 9 absolutely nailed it. No. Parachutist number 10 had a bit of trouble with his parachute and ended up hanging upside down from one of the floodlights, where he was not rescued until 45 minutes into the game. And I've just got this lovely image of him just upside down going, excuse me, can someone collect me, please?
Or just getting really angry with the football, like shouting down,
in your shape! Yeah.
Well, Beijing handled this by having lots of pre-shot footage of the fireworks.
Yeah, they did. They digitally did the fireworks, didn't they? Yeah. To make sure it would look good.
I've got... Of course they did.
Yeah, could not risk it going wrong.
No, and also the fireworks were all in the shape of Mao's face, weren't they? lot of red fireworks, weren't they? Yeah. Lot of red.
Because remember in the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in 2014, where they couldn't get... Because they don't do a torch, they do like a rod or a... This rod where they write a message of hope in it, and then the rod is like a baton, is transported around the world and arrives at the Olympic City.
Is it a message of hope going, can we forget the past 250 years of history? United Kingdom.
Well, at this one, the guy, whoever the dignitary from the Commonwealth Organising Committee, received the baton from Sir Chris Hoy, mm-hmm. and tried to open the top of it, what beside the Queen, who was waiting to read out the message of hope, and could not get the lid off the baton and tried several times. Then Chris Hoy comes in and goes, do you want a hand? And then there's the whole thing where you want to help someone who's trying to get the lid off a jar, but they're still doing it and you're going, let me have a go. And then they let you have a go and then they get back again. 35 seconds of sheer silence while the Queen looks on in a completely nonplussed way, not breaking any smile, the crowd beginning to giggle, it's all getting very awkward. Eventually the lid comes off it and even the Queen does the way throw of her hands.
Really?
I mean, probably just being charged.
Yeah.
The Queen was probably just looking at it thinking, I can open that with my tongue.
Yeah.
That was insane, that ceremony. My husband's Scottish and he's convinced that Glasgow Commonwealth Games ceremony was set up by English people, because it's just here's some tartan and tonics, tea cakes, and John Barrowman and Lulu
driving out from under a kilt
in a fountain of iron brew and some heroin. It was just
I took a look at things that weren't in the world of sport or entertainment. I had a look at the christening of ships, because that's sort of like a launching ceremony, an opening ceremony. So this goes all the way back to ancient Babylon and Rome and Greece. And the linking of alcohol and ships is sort of like a libation or a sacrifice to the gods. But the idea of smashing an actual bottle of wine or bottle of fizz into it goes back to the 17th century in the United Kingdom, and the idea of a standing cup, where they'd have a ceremony on board with a pretty expensive jewelled cup. And then the dignitary would take a sip from it and then throw it overboard, and it would then be done. And then after a while they went, God, we are wasting a lot of cups. So they got a catching net, and then they went, oh, we can't even be asked to catch it. Let's just smash some shit against the ship.
So they would have somebody whose job would be to stand off the side of a boat with a net trying to catch a solid cup flying through the air.
Yes.
And if they caught it, they were the next person to get married, presumably.
Absolutely. Yeah, married to a ship. Talking of marriage, in France in the 18th and 19th century, instead of this, you would have essentially a faux marriage ceremony where the godfather and the godmother of the ship would get married. And I really wish it was the captain getting married to the figurehead, but that's not true. In Japan, they will use a silver axe to sever a rope. But a couple of failed launchings that you need to know about. On the 3rd of July 1883 in Govan in Glasgow, the anchors failed on the SS Daphne. And whilst the starboard side went 6 yards, the port side went 60 yards, it flipped and 124 people died, mostly in front of their own relatives.
Oh, my word.
What happened when they launched SS Celeste?
Yeah. They opened it by crashing a bottle of piss into the side of it. Not long after, in 1898, HMS Albion was launched. And what this happened is it launched and it created a massive wave. And the massive wave went over to the stage where everyone was watching and destroyed the stage. And again, about 34 people died. And my favourite thing about that is that it was the first launch ever to be filmed.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
So it's all right. Tragedy plus time, guys. Tragedy plus an awful lot of time. Prince Philip is almost always an over-entitled racist, but occasionally he's funny. And in the 60s, he was in Canada opening something, and he has one of my favourite lines of any visiting dignitary ever, which is, I now declare this open. Whatever it is. But for my suggestion, we are going a couple of years back to Switzerland. This is amazing.
Yeah, I've seen this.
So this is the Gotthard Base Tunnel, which is the lowest and longest tunnel on Earth. Mm. I believe it basically goes through the Alps. There was a opening ceremony of this tunnel directed by the... rather art house German theatrical director Volker Hess, and he called on 600 actors,
It opened with a procession of tiny red milk floats, whilst a single man sat alone in lederhosen eating his lunch. Then, later on, you get several men come out dressed as ibexes, which are the traditional Swiss... Not traditional mountain goat. Just a mountain, not one of the mountain goats we've got today.
Official mountain goat.
And at one point, the man dressed as an ibex is surrounded by lots of other people dressed as hay and green hay. There is a moment when the man ibex meets a lady ibex and they begin to copulate in interpretive dance form. Later on, there were a lot of different people dressed in almost entirely in white underwear, just doing strange sort of dance moves. Mm. There's a giant screen behind it, which I'm guessing is meant to represent the hole that has been drilled, but it just looks like the Eye of Sauron. And climbing up of that, there is humans dressed as tiny sheep. And then there are three converted Volkswagen Beetles, but dressed to look like scarab beetles, because obviously the link between ancient Egypt and Switzerland is so strong that they launch up there. But far and away the worst taste thing about this, 9 construction workers died in the making of this tunnel, which is a pretty high number for something that's not involved with the Qatari World Cup. And to commemorate that, they had dancers dressed in the bright orange fluorescent workers' uniforms, whilst above them flew a topless woman with a papier-mâché baby head and angel wings.
I have the words topless baby woman angel written in my notebook.
Yeah, but that's just an idea for a poem.
Yeah.
The most fascinating thing about this is that when I started to research online, if you go down certain internet holes, you will find extreme Christian groups suggesting that this was actually a satanic ceremony organised by the Illuminati to commemorate a hole that was burrowing into the centre of the earth. It wasn't. It was just batshit, weird, absurdist paganism.
Yeah. But I said to Ben before, it's the sort of thing you go, hang on, what were they opening again? Like an opera house? No, a tunnel connecting 3 alpine countries.
Well, that, of course, is where the Satanist link comes
in. Yeah.
He's mad for tunnels.
Yeah, loves a tunnel. Loves a tunnel.
He is. I mean, admittedly, the route was called the A666. So... I mean, you would love that if the DVLA or the Roads Network in Britain opened something up and they got the Bonzo Doodah Dog Band player there. But it's utterly bizarre. It takes all of the weirdness that you find in opening ceremonies and then plays it through a filter marked European Theatre. And there are things that happen there that I think I'd only really be comfortable watching through a peephole in Amsterdam at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday.
It doesn't have the grounding aesthetic of going, oh, here's a familiar band singing a familiar song that we know, which we can hang on to for 3 minutes in the middle of this weirdness, which most opening ceremonies will do.
No, it has, here's a bit about the people we killed.
In which case, the Qatari World Cup opening ceremony is going to go on for ages. We've got some tough decisions to make.
Well, you do.
I do.
It's down to you, judge, jury and executioner of this.
Yes,
of
I
these
am.
Dubious suspects.
The dubious suspects. That's a real bargain bin knockoff version
that's
of that.
That's the band who are playing the opening ceremony, Ben. I've just booked them.
Oh, brilliant stuff. The film opens by going, it was Kaiser Soze. It was Kaiser Soze.
Who is no longer in this film. Shot of Christopher Plummer in The Sound of Music. Just sort of spliced in.
The suggestions are Barry's of the opening of Disneyland in California in 1955, replete with sticky tarmac and rampaging big cats. John's suggestion of Alan Carr's 11-minute long suicide note written in pink glittery crayon. Or my suggestion of the opening of a portal to the netherworld at the Goddard Tunnel in Switzerland. This is tricky. I'm really tempted by yours, John, but the thing is, because the Oscars are such a self-regarding, self-congratulatory glitter wank, sometimes I think Hollywood gets what it deserves. And also, Alan Carr, as you said, he was an innovator, and also, I might have misunderstood, but I think that the next year was the next year Billy Crystal's first go at doing it.
It was, and the first thing he said was, "Don't worry, I'm not Snow White."
Brilliant, there you go. And Billy Crystal is the master of the Oscars. He is to them what Stephen Fry is to the BAFTAs. And sort of because Alan Carr pulled back the catapult that resulted in Billy Crystal. I'm really tempted by my suggestion of the Gotthard Base Tunnel. This is on YouTube. Brilliantly, the broadcaster we stuck on YouTube is Russia Today.
Of course it is.
I cannot recommend highly enough eating some magic mushrooms and then projecting this opening ceremony on a big wall and watching what happens. And I'm not going to choose it, mostly because I quite enjoyed it. And also,
because you were watching it in the right context.
Yes, I was. And watching, you occasionally get a little glimpse of really uptight Swiss bankers and diplomats in the audience watching, going, what on earth is going on? Whereas the opening of Disneyland sounds like such a hellscape that I absolutely have to pick
it. I'm so glad.
Because when my children inevitably ask me to go to Disneyland, I'm going to get their Uncle Barry to tell them a little bedtime story about what goes on there.
Who says we're going to open a theme park in a year and a day? Fucking moron.
Someone with delusions of grandeur.
My favourite detail is the guy with the ladder. Just going, it's a fiver to get in. You can use my ladder to climb up.
That's the spirit of American capitalism,
exactly,
right there.
And it's 10 quid to get out.
Yeah.
and the fighting big cats.
His ancestors are camped on the southern border of America waiting for Trump to get his way.
The weeds are perfect. Because just the idea that I've got this... I've got this.
What's
snotweed is in
Latin.
What that feels like is an Alan Partridge solution to a problem right there. Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news. This week we go to Luxembourg, where those pesky EU judges have failed to see the funny side of a pizzeria that has branded itself as the Mafia. And they have said that the Spanish company are not allowed to keep this slogan because European trademark protection does not cover organised criminal institutions. basically they rejected the company's arguments about alluding to the Godfather film, and the judge said it was not right to grant legal protection to the slogan La Mafia se sienta a la mesa, the Mafia's at the table in Spanish, because it promoted an organisation known for extortion, corruption and murder.
It's a Spanish pizzeria calling itself after a Sicilian criminal organisation.
In Luxembourg.
Yeah. In Spanish.
But it was begging for, like, we'll make you some dough balls you can't refuse. Or
something.
Yeah. To the Spanish.
Yeah, just the pizza is just a giant doughy horse's head on the table. So before we go our separate ways, John, where can people find you and what can they find you doing there when they arrive?
Well, this is very, very frustrating. This is the world's worst plug because I've got a lovely theatre job coming up, but I've not been announced yet, so I can't say anything about it.
If you find John on Twitter, he'll announce it.
Which I've really built it up now. It's a nice job.
Good.
You can find me on Twitter at John Dryte, and you can find me in my house if you know where it is. I haven't really got much to plug at the moment. I'm here for the sheer joy of it.
Yay.
That's very kind of you.
Hooray. We're all off to pop outside and label all the weeds and charge people a tenner for looking at them. Until next time. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E, Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse.
Is dead. He's been eaten by the panther.
Have you seen the picture on, it was going around on one of the archival history Twitter accounts of one of the first meetings of the Mickey Mouse Club?
No.
It's about 2,000 children in the 1930s or 40s wearing what can best be described as horror store melting Mickey Mouse faces. It is the absolute stuff of nightmares.
Oh, that sounds like what everyone should have been wearing on that opening ceremony.
Damn right they should.
Do find Jonathan Dryden Taylor, aka the notorious JDT, all over Twitter.
That's not his real nickname.
It is now at John Dryte, I think it is. And you'll be able to find out all about all the upcoming shows he's doing and any other projects and all of that. And we've got fun social media shenanigans planned this week.
We absolutely do. So obviously, if you enjoy our stuff, you can follow us on Twitter on @worstfoot. Feel free to tweet suggestions at us, and we're popping out all sorts of our favourite facts from previous episodes. But also, since on Easter Monday, that is going to be our 64th episode, to celebrate, we're going to have a World Cup of the Worst Things. We're going to take the winner of every episode, we're going to pit them against each other, and some point on Easter Monday evening, we will find out which is the worst thing ever so far.
Yeah.
So if you follow us, please do get involved in the polls. Please retweet them. Please at people you think might be interested, or make it a bit more fun. And let's hope that Cambridge Analytica don't ruin the important democratic vote that we're going to have in the upcoming weekend.
Vladimir Putin is quaking that we'll draw all the fans from the World Cup in Russia to the world's worst World Cup.
I don't think we are anything that's making Vladimir Putin quake.
Would you like some tea?
I was about to say, I'm so glad that we did the World's Worst Tea episode already. Although when you were talking about the billionaires coming to blow you in that episode, clearly Putin's one of them.
I'm still waiting, by the way.
Every morning, 9 a.m, Barry is sat in his doorway with his trousers around his ankles going, "Where are you, Zuckerberg?"
Zuckerberg.
So, come on now.
I'm so sorry. Listen, we're also on Facebook if anyone else still is. find us, Worst Foot Forward, and send us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you want to find Ben and I on Twitter, Ben is at Ben Vandeveld, and I am at Baz Max Day.
We also, as ever, we're going to repeat our consistent ask to you. Please do rate and review us. We know that if you're listening to this, you probably listen to a bunch of different podcasts, and we always bang on about it. It's because we're not ITV or HBO. We can't pay advertisers to promote what we do. We need you.
We're not high on the gay agenda. Sadly.
Mate, I am full of gay fumes from the gay agenda. We need you guys to do it. So if you've got a spare minute, do you know what? Don't just do us. Pick your three favourite podcasts. We're one of them. And pop on your podcast platform of choice. Give them a 5-star review. Little words of reviewing with better diction and syntax than that.
Literally, that's your podcast right there, guys.
Yeah. and do that. That'd be really helpful. And listen, guys, we've been banging on about the BBC and HBO, but genuinely, we have been walking down the corridors of power this week, have we not, my friend?
Oh, hell yeah, baby. We went to record an episode, some of you might have seen on Twitter, we went to record an episode in the Houses of Parliament here in London during the week.
We had to try and be so respectful. And as you will know on this podcast, we have a lovely mix of genuine facts, interesting interviews, and really silly, often filthy stuff. And to be in a lovely room that was especially hired out by a lovely politician and her lovely assistant, with many, many unlovely portraits outside of old white men who have ruined the country, it felt difficult to behave.
Yes, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Tulip Sadiq, MP of the Labour Party, my local MP here in the UK, and she joined us to share her passion for fashion. We talked about the world's worst fashion accessories.
Listen, Tulip was great. She's exactly what you would want from an elected representative, and that she was a human being. You know, she was cool, she was funny, she was self-deprecating, she had invited us into her place of work and let us chat nonsense trivia at her for 45 minutes. So tune in next week and listen to Worst Foot Forward with Tulip Sadiq.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.